All right, everybody, welcome back. Episode 24 of Strength Academy. Grayson here, joined again by Mundo.
Hey, y'all, what's up?
So we have a kind of fun episode for you guys today. We thought that we would get in our time machine and go back and revisit what we did when we started out and kind of think about what we would do differently if we could do it all over again in regards to training and really anything kind of related to weightlifting. So I think the most obvious one, and we maybe won't spend a whole lot of time on it because it's so obvious, is that I think we probably both would have started when we were 13 if we had the option to. Do you kind of feel that way? Do you wish that you had found this earlier?
That is number one, the thing that I would definitely change is I would have started training at a much, much earlier age. I think that just having a lot more time to develop along with the sport, as opposed to being, you know, a completely grown adult and having, you know, multiple, not injury, because I didn't really have a whole lot of injuries prior to coming into weightlifting, but mobility limitations, things like that, that I never worked on that would have been a higher priority in obtaining to compete in the sport. I think those would have been obviously a lot more well honed in if I had just been a weightlifter growing up, like if I had started younger.
Yeah, so that's kind of my feeling, is that if you can maintain that natural flexibility you come into it with, that's always going to be the best bet. But I just thought that was kind of so clear that we could just get it out of the way.
Yeah,
first. It's like, yeah, of course we would have started, to, you know, 14, 15 rather than, you know, in our 20s.
Yeah, good call now, because that would have been the first one right out the gate. And I think it would be for most people, because like whenever you start something younger, you're just going to have more time to develop, you know, into that thing, whether it's, you know, playing an instrument or playing a sport or, you know, whatever you can imagine. The younger you start, the better off you're going to be. I mean, that doesn't mean that you'll excel and that you'll be the best at it, but you'll have a much better advantage over somebody that starts a lot later.
Like, even if I had just known what a squat was and how to do it correctly the whole time, that would have been enough for me. But I don't think I got into a deep squat with my feet flat on the ground till I was like 23 or something like that. I never did it as a kid. It kind of makes me wonder, like, do you think, like, why aren't they teaching kids how to do squats in PE in like elementary school when they can still do it? Like, you don't even you can make it part of a game, you can fit it in something, but just get them moving up and down in a squat like a little bit, right? Like, that seems like an elemental part of physical education, is moving your body around. And I don't remember doing any sort of actual physical preparation as a kid.
I don't remember doing anything that was structurally sound training as a kid. Most of it was just playing. PE consisted of like running around, playing duck duck goose, or, you know, with that parachute
thing.
The parachute thing was cool, but yeah, they never taught us, like, this is how you should squat, this is how you should pick something up off the floor if it's heavy. Yeah, so there's almost like no functionality to anything that you learn when you're in school, especially at the younger ages. I know some high schools offer weight training and things like that, but the scope is a little bit limited, and the amount of time that you have to dedicate to it is a little bit limited as well, because like you have all these other classes and all these other things going on, and if you have, what, 30, 40 students in one class, like, it's really hard to get some dedicated instruction in doing something that's very highly technical at that level.
Which is why I'm so excited about what Dee's been able to build up at a local high school here in town, where she's been able to start introducing clean and jerks and like getting these kids moving really, really well.
Right.
Since she took over that program. But I guess I would say for me, the second thing, if I was to kind of go back and change up the training, I'd probably have done a lot less stuff. When I first started lifting pretty heavily, I would go to the gym for like 4 hours and take like 2 or 3 scoops of Jack 3D and just hit shoulders for 3 hours straight and do like 11 exercises with like 4 or 5 sets each. And I had a lot of fun doing it, but I know that I really kind of like that idea that more is always better. I was just trying to do more stuff all the time rather than trying to, you know, recover from the stuff that I was doing. Did you kind of have like that annihilate yourself phase when you first started doing some weight training?
No, I think most of my weight training was just centered around trying to be stronger and more fit, like in a general sense. So I didn't really, if I could go back and change something, it would be training for something specifically. I think that makes a big difference in how you train. And like, I used to just do the normal bodybuilding routine, you know, back and biceps one day, chest and triceps, and then core, and then legs on Friday. And I didn't skip leg day, like even when I was doing bodybuilding, but even though my legs are probably like the weakest thing. But I think that most of the time I just followed like a typical moderately, you know, tough bodybuilding routine, and it suited me. So like, you know, I wasn't training for anything. I wasn't trying to be an Olympic weightlifter. I wasn't trying to be a power lifter. I was just trying to be strong and fit and, you know, fit into my uniform. So like for me, there wasn't like really a whole lot of experimentation with movements or anything like that. I'd usually just get whatever training template off of bodybuilding.com and then just, you know, go from there and just follow it. And I was pretty good at following it. I wouldn't, you know, kind of go off the farm on a lot of these programs. And I had pretty decent results. Like I'm okay-ishly strong, but not anywhere that's impressive for a weightlifter.
Well, did you, because I know this was a big mistake that I made when I was first getting into, it was more bodybuilding style training, but I didn't squat or deadlift. I'd always bench, but I didn't really do squats or deadlifts really in my programs. Mm-hmm. I would just hit hamstring curl and leg extension and leg press because they were just easier. Right. And then we deadlift just to like mess around and see how much you could lift and get yelled at for dropping plates. But, you know, I really neglected like properly training my legs at the start. And that kind of led to a pretty big deficit in regards to like just muscular balance.
Yeah. You know, the first time I squatted, I don't count the Smith machine as a barbell.
Yeah, so I think that's fair.
The first time that I squatted with the barbell was when I was 28, I think.
Okay, yeah.
Or 29. Like, I had never used a barbell before. Like, I had never had one other than to bench.
Yep.
So most of the time my leg training consisted of leg presses, hamstring curls, leg extensions, the calf machine, like loading up as much plates as you could.
You just gotta love the calf machine.
So like, I didn't really know anything about how to develop like a part of my body specifically, and I didn't know anything about full compound range movements. So most of what I did was isolated, and like I said, it was broken up into like that bodybuilding type routine. So I wish that I would have been privy to that or introduced to that much at a much younger age. I think moving with the barbell is a whole different animal than having a Smith machine help you squat, or a leg press is not the same thing. Like, it's really not.
Yeah, I mean, I really... because I plateaued pretty fast doing my 4-hour shoulder routine, you know, so I kind of was burning myself out, and I actually made some of the best progress in strength overall doing, I think it was strong lifts 5x5. It's kind of a beginner linear progression centered around compound lifts. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I found that, I was like, why didn't I do this 2 years ago? I'm making way better progress, but I'm just doing 7 exercises. Like, why do you think that so many of the like beginner weight programs and things that you see on bodybuilding.com and that sort of thing why do you think so many of them do shy away from, you know, just getting really good at the basics? Like, because I wish that, I think that was a, that's a good way of saying it. I wish that I had understood the importance of getting the basic stuff down before trying to do all the isolation things.
I think the basic stuff is just not fancy. And as I've gotten older, I've learned that the simpler things are, the better they usually are. Like, an elegant solution is usually a simple one. And so when it comes to weightlifting and things like that, I think that people want to have these fancy things in their program, but in reality, the simplest things work the best. And they're not glamorous. They're going to be, you know, relatively the same types of things every time. But if we're talking about a strength sport in which we're really only doing two or three compound movements, the variation isn't going to be like in the thousands.
Yeah,
we vary exercises up and we isolate things to create, you know, some or take care of imbalances, but I think that people, they're too fascinated with novelty, and that's why, like, a lot of those bodybuilding programs, they'll have like, oh, do this crazy, you know, tricep exercise, or, you know, bicep burnouts, sevens, and that's where all these weird rep schemes and things come in from. And I think that it draws people in, but those people don't stick with it because it's hard to see progress when things are constantly changing or the exercise is so foreign that you don't know if you're doing it right or not.
Because, yeah, I mean, we use a linear progression for a lot of our beginners, and, you know, just seeing them be excited that, oh, I squatted 3 more kilos than last week, and then I did it again the next week.
Right.
And, you know, it builds that confidence going into things. As far as, like, learning the Olympic lifts, not just kind of general strength training stuff, like, where do you feel like, I know in the past you told me that you tried doing 2 full programs at once, but aside from like what kind of things did you have errors in the way that you approached learning the Olympic lifts, that you would change going back?
I think that I would have made a lot more progress more quickly if I had been coached earlier. I think that a lot of the time that I tried to get away with doing what I could on my own, and I made progress, and it's going to be hard to not make progress if it's the first time you're doing something.
Yeah.
Because you're going to make some gains, strength-wise and technique-wise, just by the fact that you're doing these new things. But I think that there was some bad habits or some days where it's like I wasn't exactly sure if I was doing it right, where if I had had a coach or somebody to say, hey, you know, maybe try this, or maybe you can modify this portion and address this part of that lift, that would have been much more beneficial to me, and it would have progressed me a lot more quickly if I had had that, as opposed to being on my own. And I know some people can't always get away from their garage gym and things like that, but I really think, like, not having a coach kind of, like, hindered my progress for a long time. And I had a friend that was helping me, and he was helping me do, like, remote coaching, so I'd send him videos and things like that. But the feedback wasn't in real time, so I'd get feedback after I'd already done everything wrong, and then I had to try to remember it for the next time. And that's probably better than absolutely nothing, but I think being in front of a coach and having eyes watch the lifts and being able to provide modifications and those changes really made a difference. And it would have made a difference if I had gotten to that point sooner.
Yeah, I think that having eyes on definitely really helps. And then for me, like, I had, you know, eyes on because I was learning in a CrossFit gym, and, you know, I had people that were better than me at the lifts, you know, kind of helping me out with them. But the adjustments that I would get would be things like, you know, try to, you know, keep your weight on your heels or whatever the coaching cues that we were kind of flowing around were. But my biggest weakness when I was starting out trying to learn the lifts is that my flexibility was really, really bad. So I couldn't arch my back in a snatch start position. I couldn't even do like a conventional deadlift without a rounded back.
Yeah.
So like my lumbar was kind of always in flex, and my hips would tip really far forward when I'd squat. So I'd always either be powering things or rounding my back to stay under them. And I was doing these, you know, long 2 hour sessions or, you know, and sticking around and doing dips for an hour or whatever. I don't know how I had the energy to do some of the stuff that I did, but if I had taken half of that time and just seriously worked on stretching, I would have made progress twice as fast because the positions would have been so much better. And I ended up suffering a pretty bad back injury around the time that I was starting to hit pretty decent weights. But because my mobility was so bad, I was just structurally not in a place that I could handle it.
Right.
And my back went out on me, and that took me, you know, a year to recover from. But it forced me to take that step back and work on the mobility and do things like single leg RDLs to improve my hip hinge and work on hamstring flexibility and start deadlifting at like the mid thigh and just lower it an inch every week until I could get it perfect off the ground. Mm-hmm. And if I had just taken 2 or 3 months at the beginning to lift lighter weights and work on that stuff versus trying to follow, because it was a class format, so trying to follow the group program where I was able to move the weights, but the quality was so insufficient that I just ended up getting hurt.
Yeah.
So if I could go back, I mean, just making sure that I always put that like flexibility and core strength and that sort of stuff, making that more of a priority. But I think that so many of us, and I mean, we certainly see this with people that get really eager with things, is it's easy to focus on just being really intense and wanting to get more weight up. And you don't really care if you pressed out because you got more weight up.
Yeah.
And if that's kind of the culture of the gym that you're in, where nobody's going to call you out on that press out or make fun of you about your soft elbows, you know, you end up just kind of getting away with it, but you end up doing things that, well, won't count in a competition
right.
and are potentially hazardous to your back or elbows health, you know? So I think that like the mobility aspect for me would be like one of the biggest things.
Yeah, I think maybe one of the other things that, like, looking back, and I know CrossFit is responsible for me becoming a weightlifter because I wanted to be better at weightlifting so I could be a better CrossFitter. And I think that if I had skipped CrossFit altogether and just started weightlifting, like, I wouldn't have had as many bad habits.
Yeah, I could see that.
Because I learned a lot of, like, bad things about just rushing through a lift. And even then, I was still a stickler for trying to do things right. But I'm just going to say this. A two-day seminar doesn't make you an expert in weightlifting. And going for, you know, a class for 2 hours on a Saturday isn't going to make you a snatch expert. Like, these are things that you have to practice over and over again. And a coach doesn't develop the ability to see, like, mistakes and things like that over a two-weekend, you know, or a one-weekend, two-day seminar. Like, it's just, anybody that tells you otherwise is selling you a load of bullshit. Because it took me years to know what something should look like. And then what it should look like depending on the person performing it.
Yeah.
Because not everybody has the same limb length. Not everybody has the same torso length. People have different start and setup positions based on the proportions of their body. So what might not look correct might actually be correct for them. And your ability to differentiate and do that, you know, comes with time. So, like, when I first started weightlifting, I didn't have anybody watching me, and people would still try to be encouraging. They'd still try to say, oh, hey, keep your chest up, or, you know, big pull. But, like, those aren't cues because they didn't translate to anything for me. Like, they're just encouragement.
Yeah.
Like, and
it's cheerleading.
People, yeah, it's cheerleading. And there's a difference between cheerleading and cueing. And I didn't have anybody cueing me. I had a lot of cheerleading. And I appreciate that encouragement. That encouragement didn't transfer over into anything productive, though. Like, it didn't make me lift better. It didn't make me more technically sound or stronger. And I think that a lot of the time people, if I would have gone back and started with a weightlifting coach on a weightlifting team, I would have been probably headed in a different direction a lot sooner than I had.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I think if I had known that weightlifting was going to be what I wanted to go into, then just going straight into that and would have, you know, kind of cut some of the middle road out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think on your point, you know, I've been to a lot of really good seminars, and you can always pick up like a good piece of information or a good way of thinking about something. But yeah, I mean, the most useful thing for, you know, my developing as a coach and continued development is just watching more people lift.
Yeah.
The more people you watch, the better that is. And I think that also incorporates into what you can do to be better as a lifter. Like, if I had paid closer attention to watching good lifters on the internet or, you know, in person, and like gone to meets and like actually tried to see what was happening a little bit more,
yeah,
instead of just trying to rip the weight off the ground, because that was my idea, you know. I think that, you know, that observation, like spending more time like analyzing what people are doing and trying to really think about it in depth rather than thinking of it as, I guess it's just changing the way that I think about the lifts might be another thing. Because when I first started, I thought of the lifts as get this heavy weight over your head. And now I think of it as a much more like precision and fluidity focused thing, where it's just getting the movement really well, and then the weight's going to be up there and it's going to feel easy,
right?
Versus like trying to really strain and grunt your way through a workout. I think that just changing my mentality. But then again, I don't actually know if me as a 23-year-old was prepared to have a not over the top aggressive mentality towards lifting. So I don't know if it was, you know, so like these are things that, you know, if we could go back, we probably would have lifted more. But if we went back and did all those things, we wouldn't know half of the stuff that we do now.
That's true.
You know, so no, all of these things are, you know, it's like, oh, there's the error I made. But I maybe wouldn't want to completely erase that, because I feel like that, you know, struggling with getting the mobility down and that sort of stuff has made me much better able to help other people that are struggling with the same thing that I did. So yeah, like, you know, it's like, hey, I wouldn't want to erase this, but I think those are definitely a few of the mistakes. I oftentimes think that I was so interested in how you program and the use of different exercises and how to do different, you know, training techniques. And I experimented on myself constantly. So I would do one style of programming, and then I'd do this, and then I'd do that, and I'd try to squat 9 times a week versus 2 times a week. And I think I did so many experiments, but because I was programming for myself, you know, I think if I had wrote one program and just did it 10 times in a row, I might have, if I had the discipline to just be like, no, I'm going to keep doing this.
Right.
But then again, it's the same thing where it's, well, I was just interested in the theory, so I wanted to do the experiment. But, you know, so, I mean, I kind of think about all of the nutrition and lifting stuff as, you know, you're doing a science experiment on yourself. You know, it's, you're trying to manipulate your body to do what you want.
Right.
Through, you know, adjusting a stimulus here and an input or an output here. I think I probably could have eaten better. I probably would have, which was hard because there were times that I was eating poorly because I was just flat broke in college.
Sure.
But, you know, I always, you know, had a good focus on protein. And after I got out of the Army, I never really fell into the supplement trap, you know, where you're like buying every kind of like pre-workout, post-workout, intra-workout, whey protein, casein protein, right, vitamins, creatine. Like I realized pretty quickly that most of that stuff was just a huge waste of money. But I think I still, you know, ate, if I had shifted my focus away from just pounding Sour Patch Kids all the time, and, you know, because, like, it is cool when you realize that when you're training really hard, you can kind of get away with eating some slop every now and then, right, and, like, it's, like, a cool feeling to be like, yeah, I'm still pretty buff, but I can eat, like, you know, a sleeve of Oreos, but that catches up to you in that it makes your joints feel terrible.
Right.
So, like, I think if I had had, like, a healthier approach to my diet, you know, making sure to do more, you know, less, you know, pasta and bread and pizza and stuff like that, and just kept it more to just eating more higher quality food rather than trying to eat easy-to-eat food.
Right.
I think that probably would have led me hurting a lot less.
Yeah, and well, it's like you said though, sometimes you gotta kind of make do with what you can get a hold of, and everybody's situation's different. There's people that if they put the amount of money that they put into supplements into regular food, like, they might have a whole completely different set of results.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
body composition wise and just feeling in general. I think that I don't remember. I think on one deployment, I spent like $200 on supplements. Like, but everything that I needed was provided for me at the chow hall. Like,
yeah.
Everything that I could have possibly like wanted to eat, but like BCAAs and pre-workout and post-workout and creatine and, you know, extra protein and all that stuff, like vitamins and all that stuff. That, I mean, there's a whole industry that's surrounded by that type of stuff. Because people buy it and they're looking for shortcuts or whatever. But I know we talked about this last time. It's like that there's no biological free lunch. So all that crap you're putting in your body is going to have some kind of result down the road, or even at that time, you know. And even if the result's just like a dent in your wallet, you know. So I don't know. I don't mind the supplementation. Like, I know creatine works. I know, like, sometimes vitamin deficiencies are a thing. Like, you got to get some vitamin D3 to supplement.
Vitamin D is kind of the big one.
Yeah.
The multivitamin, they've done the, and I don't really trust epidemiology all that much, but the studies they have done comparing populations that take a multivitamin to don't, there's really no improvement.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's what I'm saying, is just like, there's not really a huge benefit from it. You just eat food, eat better quality foods, as often as you can. And a lot of people skip the vegetables, but you gotta get some of them in there sometime.
Well, and I think the hard thing with, you know, eating the good quality food is, people struggle making it taste like something they want to eat.
Right.
So, like, being able to, like, one of the best things, so this isn't something I change, but it's something I encourage people to do, is learn how to cook well.
Yeah.
Because if you get pretty good at baking chicken thighs or, you know, making, you know, your rice not crunchy when you're cooking it, you're going to enjoy the foods that you're eating a lot more. So if you just are under seasoning things and eating this bland grilled chicken breast, of course you're not really going to have that fun of a time, you know, trying to eat all the calories you're supposed to eat. And you're going to want to opt for drinking a giant bottle of chocolate milk to get 800 calories.
Yes.
But if you're able to, you know, prepare those chicken thighs and like braise them and like learn how to do these little things that you can do for batch cooking, but just make simple ingredients taste a lot better. Learning to cook is one of the best ways to stick to a diet. Cause if you can eat healthy foods, but prepare them in a way that doesn't taste like a cold chicken breast and steamed broccoli.
Yeah.
Like, if you can make that taste really good and make it feel luxurious that you're eating healthy food, that makes it so much easier to stick to a diet.
How do you... Okay, so maybe this is really important. And how do people learn how to cook? Because this is really sad, but a lot of people don't know how to cook for themselves. And it's like, maybe that's part of the problem. Is just like, it's just easier to go get something to eat.
But it's like, always way easier.
But
yeah.
How did you learn to cook? Like, how did you teach yourself to cook?
So, I mean, well, I guess like growing up, my dad was always a pretty big cook. So like, I just kind of had it as a template in my head that you make dinner.
Okay.
So like that was something that it didn't seem abnormal to me, but, yeah, I remember the first few forays into cooking in the Army, it was just like a train wreck. Like, it was just like so dry and tough. But what I ended up doing is I would look for things I could make big batches of. So I'd make a lot of chili and curries. I'd do, you know, various vegetables sautéed. And I just kind of would look up a recipe. And once I've made that recipe a couple times, then I'd try to do it from memory the next time. So, like, when you're looking at recipes, like, just try to cook a bunch of different stuff. You can get free recipes all over the place. And the best way to sharpen your skills for doing it is to just practice.
Yeah.
Because you're going to make some stuff that's kind of a flop. But then, you know, once you've made tomato sauce for the 15th time, you kind of just know how to make it now. So you don't need the recipe anymore. So you know the, like, trying to, like, break it down to, like, oh, I know that tomato sauce is usually like aromatic vegetables, canned tomatoes, some beef broth. Now, do I want to make a meat sauce? Cool, I'll involve sausage in there when I'm cooking the onions. So like you kind of like, yeah, so trying different recipes and trying to pay attention to like what's similar between them. Like once I realized that just put salt and pepper on everything right away.
Yeah.
And then garlic powder if you want something different, or like if you have the time to chop garlic.
Right.
But like just getting little basic things down of like, oh, make sure that you salt your meat before you cook it. I just got a really great book for Christmas that I'm kind of making my way through. It's the Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat.
Oh, yeah.
That's a really cool book because that... isn't a recipe book, but it's a concepts thing. So like, it's like, hey, here's the principles behind what kind of salt to use or how to bring acidity to a dish and how to balance flavors. Mm. So it's kind of just like general guidelines, but I'd say the biggest thing is just practicing. Yeah. Like
just like everything else, right?
Yeah. Pick a recipe. Like once, like it doesn't have to be constant every day, but if you pick a difficult thing to make once a week, the skills that you learn trying to make that will make your cauliflower rice more delicious on Tuesday when you're meal prepping.
All right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So, Mundo, you've been thinking about something this week. We got some time to get into it?
Yeah, let's get into it. So I've kind of been mulling over this concept of like self-improvement and self-optimization and things like that. And a lot of the time, we're pressured as a society or as individuals to be better, be more, do more. And I think that there's a lot of promotion and emphasis on being your best self and whatever that means to you as an individual. And I've just been wondering, like, for what? Why? Like, why does it matter how much or what you achieve, you know, on an individual basis? And then, because, like, our society is very individualistic. Americans are very individualistic. What's in it for me? What do I get out of it? Like, how does this benefit me? And most of our transactions, I think, are done with that in our subconscious. So when people ask us for favors, or they ask us for help or advice, that mentality kind of shines through in like, well, how is this going to benefit me if I help this person out? Like, and we shouldn't be like that. But to me, like, why are we like that? Like, why does it matter if you're your best self? Why do you have to get up and take a picture of your watch at 4 a.m. to prove to people that, you know, you're on the grind and you're doing, you know, you're your best self? Like, where does that come from, and why is it important that people continue to do it?
Well, I think that, you know, it that kind of makes me think of a couple of different things. So the first one being that I think, like, a good word that I've heard used to describe kind of the way that our society is now is that it's kind of atomized, where it's not a, you know, family, like a family unit is mom, dad, kids, mm-hmm. most likely not that, just one parent, one kid.
Right.
You know, like that's the common thing. Everybody, you know, kind of has these separate jobs that don't really have anything to do with each other. Like, what I do doesn't really relate to what my neighbors do. So that kind of makes everybody kind of just isolated in their own little houses. And I think that a lot of the ways that people talk about self-improvement isn't really about determining what that person truly wants. It's not really about that person going out and achieving their goals or dreams, mm-hmm. but it's them adopting the goals and dreams of the society. Because if you know, if your idea of self-improvement is to have, you know, the nicer car or make more money or these sort of things, are those really your drives, or are they drives that you're taking up from, you know, the culture that we live in? So, you know, because there's some ideas of, you know, self-optimization where, you know, you want to be making progress, but that progress doesn't necessarily need to be the context of, like, what other people see as good. Like, if your goal is to do as little as possible, yeah. you know, like, if your yeah. goal is, you know, to kind of get out of that system, then your self-improvement might not really match up with, you know, what Tony Robbins is telling you.
Right.
But I don't know. I think that there is a kind of innate drive to improve your circumstances. And I think that the self-help industry kind of preys on that in people, because it says, here's the easy way to do that. So it's like, it's like, here are 12 rules for this, right. or 5 ways to ensure this, or, you know, there's always steps.
7 habits of a highly effective person.
Exactly. So it kind of makes it seem like this is an easy process if you follow these things.
Right.
But I think that the process of really being who you want is going to be a more difficult process. And there isn't going to be an easy rule book of really becoming who you want to be. You know, because, like, I think that, you know, is if those 12 rules work for every single person, we're all just being the same person.
Right. Yeah. Well, so here's one thing that I thought about, and it was when you're trying to change something about yourself, you're trying to improve, whether it's your diet, your lifestyle, your body composition, your habits, people broadcast those things and say, well, this is my goal. Like, this is what I'm aiming for. And, you know, maybe eventually they'll give you the outcome of what their process was, like, whether they achieved it or not. A lot of the time, if people don't achieve anything, they don't say anything about it.
That's right? Very true.
So, like, it was like, oh, well, I my goal was this, but I didn't reach it because I just gave up on it, or it didn't work out, or whatever. But you don't hear those things. You only hear the times when people actually met their goal. And so what I thought about was that when you don't reach those things, like, it's still part of the process, because failure is part of improvement as well.
Yeah.
But when you're when you are trying to do something to better yourself, I think the best indicator is somebody telling you that you've changed. Not necessarily you broadcasting it to other people, but like, oh man, I've noticed you haven't really been drinking that much. Like, you know, did you change something? He's like, yeah, I just decided not to drink very much. Or, and then other people notice, or they're like, wow, you've lost a lot of weight. Like, what have you been doing? So like, you're not broadcasting what you're doing. You're just doing it and other people are noticing. And I think that's like a good indicator of you staying on track with something, committing to it. And then when other people notice that you've changed, then that's, I think that's the real indicator of self-improvement.
Yeah. I think it's gotta be, something that, you know, is noticeable. And I, you know, that kind of made me think that, I once heard some people kind of discussing a study they did where they found that, the danger in widely broadcasting your goals, like, it's good to tell some people if you're working towards something,
right?
But the danger of doing like a big social media new year new me post is that the likes that you get on that, or the comments you get, like, oh, good for you for setting a goal, they give you premature rewards. So the reward center of your brain turns on every time somebody hits that like button. And then it sort of feels like you already did it.
Right.
You know? Yeah, so, so like, you're before, yeah, rewarded without, for setting the goal rather than accomplishing the goal. So that can sometimes make people a little more like listful with like how they're working through things. Because if you're getting this, you know, positive feedback and it's kind of making you not need to be working as hard towards that thing that you set out to do. And I think this kind of ties into, you know, somebody that's always going to be coming up in here is, you know, so Nietzsche's idea that the primary drive in life is the accumulation of power. So that, you know, and that can be any number of things to anybody. That doesn't mean that you're out Genghis Conning the neighborhood. But, so like the ability to change your circumstances is what everyone is searching for. And that kind of rings true to me because of the popularity of that self-help stuff, where it's like, everybody's just trying to have some modicum of control over their existence.
Right.
And, but what I think is, what might be part of the problem is that instead of people's personal will to power expressing itself as, I want to run this business, or I want to, you know, live off the land and be off the grid, or I want to build these relationships with this community, are replaced by what the broader society looks at as power. So like, you know, you're sacrificing. Like, so the greatest strive would be to have the utmost control over your life, that you're doing as many things in the day that are your choice entirely.
Right.
And if you're supplementing or like sublimating the goals that are kind of just like the society level, here's what success is, and not just building your own, what do you want to do every day? What is your perfect day? And then striving and working towards that. So I think that there's, you know, maybe it's like artificially dictated value, you know?
Artificially dictated value.
So like,
that's an interesting concept. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a...
Because we should be working towards things, because you don't want to be stagnant.
Right.
But you should be working towards your things, not what your parents want you to do or what, you know, the TV says is like an awesome way to live.
Right.
Like, you shouldn't be striving to be to have your group of friends be the guys from the Miller Lite commercial, you know?
Right.
Because I think that that's, well, maybe we have a little bit of time to explore. Like, do you think a lot of it comes from people just want to be, they associate comfort with happiness? Like, they think that to be happy is to be like absent of struggle, and that they're really just trying to avoid doing the hard work.
Yeah, actually, I think that's a very good observation. I think that happiness doesn't always have to coincide with comfort, but I do think that people attribute being comfortable to being happy. And I think maybe the emphasis shouldn't be on that as much as it should be on doing the things that we want to do for the reasons that we want to do them. And that's the difference. So like if you're 30 and you think that you should have the perfect job, you're married, your soulmate, you know, have a dog and maybe a child on the way pretty soon. Like if that's your measure of success, like why is that your measure of success? Like, and if you're trying to do like self-optimization things to get to those points, like why?
Like have you evaluated the goals that you're setting?
Yeah, I was like, is it because your parents want grandkids? Is it because like all your friends are getting married or have the perfect, they seem to have the perfect career? Because a lot of the time you guys meet up for drinks and you're complaining about your jobs and your significant others and like how much responsibilities and things you have, and it just seems like oxymoronic a lot of time to have these things attribute to what is considered to be successful and building yourself up to obtain those things when those things are the same things that are causing you grief and, you know, making you, you know, miserable.
Yeah, because it's just, if I could earn $5,000 more a year, I'll finally be happy.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, as opposed to like the times that, you know, I've had, you know, the most happy experiences are all the result of really hard, struggly ones. Yeah. You know, like there's never been a just like content and passive happiness. It's always been setting in a difficult goal and accomplishing that, or overcoming something to, you know, come out on the other side, and you know, taking risks and having them pay off or fail. If even if they fail, whatever comes next is always going to be building on that, and like seeking like comfort or complacency, I think makes people feel really alienated because they're not satisfying that internal urge to, you know, do whatever you want.
Right. Well, I think so like for me, for instance, one of the areas that I struggle with is like relationships and dating. And so like a lot of my self-optimization efforts are in those areas. Like, how do I become a better man so I attract a better woman? Like, how do I attract the mate that I want? And so a lot of my self-optimization efforts and my self-help dives are into those realms of improvement. So like, but at what point is it like, who says I have to have a relationship or I have to get married? And I don't knock anybody for the relationships that they do like get into. But for me, like that's the area that I most struggle with. So that's the area that I see the most deficiency of myself in. And so I'm trying to find ways to like better myself. But at the end of the day, it's just like, well, if I did find somebody, this feeling, am I trying to just fill a hole, right? And putting that pressure on that other person to fill that spot in my life that I think is missing, when in reality it's really not. It's just, I think it is because I just see other people around me having these things. Like, it's just like when people can't have kids and then they see everybody, all the couples around them have kids, you know? So it's like the one thing in your life that you think you're deficient in, the thing that you think you're lacking, it makes you insecure. So for me, like my insecurity is that, oh, I'll never really find anybody to relate with and to have a relationship with on a deep, you know, intimate level. So all my self-help efforts are on that. But like I said, in reality, like why?
Well, like, yeah, I mean, is that, you know, you filling a need that you actually feel like you're wanting to work towards, or is that you just, you know, kind of having been brought up in a world that says that this is what you do, you know, that feeling of being against the grain, you know, so is it that, you know, it's a thing that you really want or really care about, or is it that that feeling of not being in the normal swing of things makes you feel uncomfortable?
I think that's what it is more than anything, is just like, well, the normal thing is to, you know, do that, to have a job, to have a relationship, to have kids, to, you know, that's the normal set of like successors, right? So if you're, for me, if I feel like I'm lacking in that area, maybe it does feel uncomfortable because I'm outside of what's considered a standard type of, you know, situation, yeah, or behavior.
You're being the anomaly.
Yeah, I'm outside of the box. And it's not easy, like, staying in that space.
Yeah, and I think that's the, you know, discomfort that comes from doing what you want. But if you know, staying outside of that box is what you want, and because of that, you travel outside of the country 4 times more than you ever would have not being in that position.
Right. Yeah.
Then, you know, it's what goals of yours are you accomplishing? And does that, you know, image of what we're supposed to be doing fit with that? And if it doesn't, reject it. I mean, like,
I had the conversation the other day with my daughter about, like, I had her really young, right? I had her when I was 19. So now she's almost 18. She'll be 18 this year, and I'm 30. I'll be 37 this year. So, like, I'm old enough to be able to do things with her in a physically active way. Like, we can go bow hunting together. We can go travel together. Like, she doesn't have to take care of me. Like, she's not my retirement plan. Like, so, like, I'm not like raising her so that she'll you know, replace me as my caregiver.
Yeah.
To replace me as, you know, the caregiver. So, like, I get to enjoy the things that I want to enjoy, but I also get to take her along. And I think that if I would have had her older, like, much older, like, it would hinder me from doing the things that I want to do. Like, I want to travel more. But if I would have had a baby, if I had a baby right now, that would suck, because, like, I wouldn't be able to go anywhere. You're not going to take a 1-year-old to Thailand with you.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't want to anyway. I mean, you can.
So because, you know, you kind of broke the mold of what is the responsible age to have a kid.
Right.
You ended up being able to do more of what you want now.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's I don't know. I think that the more time you can spend doing the things that you want to do, that's where your contentment's going to lie. That's where, you know, you'll be maybe not just over the top happy, but I don't know. I'd rather feel like I did something than just like blind happiness, you know?
Yeah, no. And I agree with that. I think that, it really just comes down to what each person individually wants out of their own life. And, you know, if you spent your younger years, your mid-20s and stuff, you know, sowing your wild oats, as they say, you know, and doing all the crazy things that you wanted to do when you're younger and you're ready to settle down in your 30s, that's fine. But, like, I'm living the Benjamin Button life, and if that's the scenario, like, I'm going backwards. Like, I had a lot less freedom and free time when I was younger, and as I'm getting older, I'm having a lot more freedom and free time to do the things that I want to do. And, you know, I think that's the hard part, where it's hard to fit in that extra person that lines up, because you want to be going in the same direction at the same pace, you know.
Yeah.
And things like that, and a lot of people aren't on that track.
Yeah, it's hard to, you know, get into a position where things sync up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think overall, yeah, I think that a lot of that alienation stuff comes from people kind of being forced to do things that they don't really want to do.
Yeah, it's not comfortable being on the outside of what people consider the normal standard of behavior.
But I think that, you know, that freedom of being on the outside kind of allows you to really live. So I'd encourage everybody to do something reckless.
Do something reckless. All right, y'all. So that pretty much wraps off the podcast for today. So going over a couple of things. If you could go back and change some things, I would definitely, you know, if you're starting earlier, that's good. I would definitely seek out a coach. If you're starting out,
focus on the basics.
Focus on the basics is definitely a good one. Learn how to cook for yourself.
Yes.
And then on the flip side with philosophy, just think about, you know, the things that you value, why you do them. If you want to be a better person, why? Why do you want to be a better person?
Is it for yourself? And how are you defining it?
Yeah, and how are you defining it? So, yeah, that includes being a weightlifter. So,
yep.
Any last things you want to add, Grayson?
Go ahead and subscribe, rate, review on iTunes, guys. It would really help us out. Tell your friends, and we'll see you next week for another episode of Strength Academy.
All right, if y'all don't follow us, it's on Instagram at Albuquerque Strength Academy. And Facebook is Albuquerque Strength Academy as well. And then you can find us on the website. Same thing, albuquerquestrengthacademy.com. All right, y'all. Happy lifting.
Take care.